This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, May 31st, 2007. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Ad Abogado. Coming up in today's newscast, following the death of a Guantanamo Bay detainee, human and civil rights groups are calling for an independent investigation. The Department of Justice widens its probe into improper hiring and firing of U.S. attorneys. And Palestinian refugees flee the violence in northern Lebanon, where fighting continues for the 11th straight day. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. President Bush called on 15 world powers today to agree on a program to curb greenhouse gas emissions. The speech comes just days ahead of the start of the G8 Summit of Wealthy Nations. The Bush administration has on numerous occasions rejected pressure to institute measures to combat global warming. Instead of focusing on the targets established by the Kyoto Protocol, Bush has instead called for a series of meetings with the world's top polluters to agree on a common goal. Meanwhile, ExxonMobil continues its refusal to set targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The world's most profitable company rejected several environmental resolutions during its shareholder meeting on Wednesday. FSRN's Renee Feltz reports.
Shareholders focused on soaring profits voted with ExxonMobil management to defeat more than a dozen global warming resolutions. But their concern about climate change has increased from previous years. 31% of shareholders voted for Exxon to set reduction goals for greenhouse gas emissions from both its operations and its products. Fellow oil giants Shell, Chevron, and BP have already agreed to emission limits. A three-state coalition for responsible investment unsuccessfully tried to oust Exxon's public issues chairman, Michael Boskin. Boskin refused their repeated invitations to discuss financial risks due to climate change and the company's failure to reduce emissions. Earlier this year, Exxon made headlines by agreeing to stop funding groups that mislead the public on global warming. But the latest Greenpeace USA analysis finds Exxon continues to fund major climate skeptics. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz.
The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a federal lawsuit against the subsidiary of Boeing Commercial Aviation Services, alleged to have knowingly participated in the CIA's extraordinary rendition program. The San Jose, California-based company Jeppesen Data Plan is accused of having provided direct flights and logistical support to a total of 15 aircraft on at least 70 occasions. ACLU Executive Director Anthony Romero.
We filed this lawsuit against Jeppesen because we felt it was important to hold the corporation accountable for its complicity in the rendition and torture programs of the U.S. government. U.S. corporations should not be able to reap profits off of a program that is illegal and violates the basic values of Americans' individuals.
The lawsuit is on behalf of three men who remain incarcerated in detention centers in Guantanamo Bay, in Morocco, and in Egypt. A ruling by Thailand's constitutional tribunal to disband the country's former ruling party and bar more than 100 of its members from participating in electoral politics has sparked domestic criticism. Supporters of the Thai Rak Thai Party and the ousted prime minister rallied today in Bangkok, despite a large police presence on the streets of the Thai capital. Former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra issued a statement from exile in London, urging his supporters to remain calm and accept the verdict. A military coup ousted Shinawatra and his party last year. A constitutional referendum is to take place in September. The industrial toxin melamine, which showed up in animal feed ingredients from China and was blamed for killing thousands of pets, has now been detected in feed made by an Ohio firm. Matt Kay reports from Washington, D.C.
Tembec of Toledo used melamine as a binding agent in feed pellets that were then sold to Uniscope of Johnstown, Colorado, which made them into three finished feeds, one for livestock, two for fish and shrimp. Uniscope tested for and found melamine in the Tembec pellets and reported it to the FDA on May 18th. Sarah Klein is a staff attorney with the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
Once again, again, we're seeing that FDA is closing the barn door long after the cows have left because they lack the mandatory authority to recall food, even when we know that contaminants like melamine have been introduced into animal or human feed. FDA can't really do much about it except ask these companies to cooperate.
Tembec has just now formally recalled its products and stopped adding melamine, but only months after the pet food scandal and possibly years of use. FDA officials promise full investigation, but claim Tembec's melamine levels are so low, there is no risk to animals or humans. In Washington, Matt Kay for Free Speech Radio News.
And finally, Mexican public school teachers knocked down metal police barricades yesterday near the country's interior secretariat before moving on to protest outside of the headquarters of broadcast media giant Televisa. The teachers faced off with Mexico City and federal riot police outside of Televisa as they called for airtime to explain why they have been protesting for weeks against reforms to the country's social security system for state workers. They say the media giant has been misrepresenting their demands and has been running a smear campaign against those who have been mobilizing against the deep cuts to public sector pensions. Teachers from across Mexico will converge on the Capitol tomorrow to march and to carry out acts of nonviolent civil disobedience, including the blocking of major roads and the takeover of toll booths to allow vehicles to pass for free. Mexico City's police chief today requested assistance from the Federal Preventative Police to contain the protests. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
A detainee at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center was found dead in his cell yesterday. The U.S. military calls it suicide, but some groups are demanding an independent investigation. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The Pentagon says a Saudi Arabian detainee was an al-Qaeda foot soldier. He was important enough to have in custody that he would not have been transferred or put up for release. But he was not considered to have lots of information, says DOD spokesperson J.D. Gordon, and he had not been charged with a crime. This is the fourth person the U.S. has said has committed suicide at Guantanamo Bay in the past year. The military plans to release the detainee's name and some more information on him later this evening. The military also says they're opening an investigation into the circumstances of the death. Jamil Al-Jafri is director of the American Civil Liberties Union's National Securities Program.
We don't know the details around this death, and we don't know the details around the previous deaths because there haven't been independent investigations of these incidents. But we do know the conditions in which prisoners have been held at Guantanamo. We do know that most of them are held in, well, all of them are held in indefinite detention. There really is no, the way that the prisoners see it, there really is no hope for a fair legal process, and there really is no realistic hope for release. And that is, I think, one of the factors that's causing this kind of despair.
The death of this detainee highlights the unforeseeable end to inmates' detention at Guantanamo Bay. Of the 380 remaining detainees, less than 10 are charged with a crime, and the Pentagon hopes to find enough evidence to charge a few dozen more. Only one, David Hicks of Australia, has been arraigned. He was transferred to his home country to serve the rest of his sentence.
It's a national disgrace. It has been, and it still is.
Thomas Sullivan is an attorney in Chicago. He's part of a team that represents 18 detainees. He says the six detainees he spent time with have not threatened suicide. Instead, he says, they've become very reflective.
The equanimity with which they conduct themselves. I think they've been in jail so long and have such strong religious beliefs in predestination and Allah's will that they take it day by day and have adopted what we would call a rather philosophical attitude.
Peace groups, human rights groups, and members of Congress consist of those calling for the closure of Guantanamo Bay. But as Jamil Al-Jafri says, there's no sign of that.
Only a couple weeks ago, they brought yet another prisoner who had been in CIA custody to Guantanamo. That prisoner became the 15th prisoner, I think, to be transferred from CIA custody to Guantanamo. That is actually particularly troubling because it tells us not only that the Defense Department seems to be committed to keeping Guantanamo open, at least in the short term, But it tells us that the CIA's secret prison system is still operative.
The president said the CIA detention program was closed in September of 2006. Unsure if it's still in existence, the Senate Intelligence Committee asked for an immediate completion of a legal review of the detention program. The committee said it needs to be evaluated, but did not go so far to call for its permanent closure. Meanwhile, the arraignment hearings of two Guantanamo Bay detainees begins on Monday. Salim Hamdan, the detainee who challenged detention proceedings in the Supreme Court, and the other of Omar Khadr, a Canadian national captured when he was just 15. Khadr fired his U.S. attorney and will represent himself. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
President Bush's latest nominee to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is receiving ardent opposition to his nomination. Judicial watchdogs, women's groups, and civil rights organizations say Leslie Southwick is not the man for the job. Al Green is a U.S. representative from Texas and member of the Congressional Black Caucus.
We are adamantly opposed to Judge Southwick. He, early on in his career on this bench that he presently serves, heard a case wherein one worker referred to another worker as a good old N-word. And in so doing, the worker was terminated by the state agency that she was working for. That was the Mississippi Department of Human Services. That termination was finally brought before Judge Southwick. And Judge Southwick, in upholding the return of the worker to work, Judge Southwick thought that that worker should be permitted to go back into the workplace with impunity after having said this, and did so by concurring with other judges who concluded that the findings of the hearing officer was correct when the hearing officer concluded that the use of the N-word in that context was comparable to calling a person a teacher's pet, a teacher's pet. That is offensive, but it is also injurious because you create a hostile work environment when you condone these kinds of invidious comments.
That was Al Green, U.S. representative from Texas and member of the Congressional Black Caucus. Rights groups also oppose Southwick because of a ruling he supported that took away custody from a parent based on sexual orientation. The Alliance for Justice says he sides with business and against employees and consumers. This is the third person George Bush has nominated to fill the vacant seat. The first two were rejected because of their record on civil rights cases. The appeals court presides over Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Southwick must receive Senate confirmation to obtain the post. The Senate Judiciary Committee could approve him as early as next week. The Department of Justice is expanding its probe into the hiring and firing of U.S. attorneys in its Civil Rights Division, the department that, in part, oversees voting rights. In a letter to the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, the DOJ Inspector General said they will investigate allegations of improper hiring practices in that department. Numerous staff, including career civil rights attorneys, have left the Civil Rights Division. Toby Moore is a former redistricting expert for the department. He said he left after 6 years of service because of a hostile environment where political considerations took precedent over the law.
Our role became less to analyze and impartially enforce voting laws, but instead our job became to support the administration's priorities, which were often both ideological and partisan driven. I think the best example of that was the Georgia voter ID law that was passed by an almost entirely on party lines in Georgia, was considered to have partisan impact, and we were simply not able to protect black voters from what I thought was a very discriminatory law.
How would you characterize the impact of a lot of these partisan decisions on voting and the democratic process?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind that we live in a time of great polarization, but also very narrow margins of victory. So small impacts, for instance, on voter registration rolls for getting voters kicked off if they haven't voted in the several elections, or kicking off voters who are thought to be have felony convictions and therefore be ineligible to vote. Small differences in voter turnout and voting can have great impacts, and we've seen that with the control of Senate. The control of the Senate went to the Democrats only after some very, very close elections in Virginia, Montana, Missouri, that would have been greatly impacted by very small changes in the law, say voter ID laws, or in the administration of voter registration rolls. And I think that's really what's driving the attention that particularly the Bush administration paid to election laws.
And what do you think needs to happen within the Civil Rights Division to improve the decision-making process before the next election season?
Well, I think in the short term, there needs to be the replacement of the section leadership that was put in place by now discredited political appointees. That's the first immediate step. The second step is to restore impartiality to the hiring process, to make it more make the decision making more transparent and more accountable. This is a department wide problem, as I think the U.S. Attorney scandal has shown, and it's going to take a departmental wide solution, starting with a new Attorney General. And starting with, I think some kind of independent commission or review board that looks at what happened, that looks at ways to fix what happened and to prevent it from happening again.
Toby Moore is a former geographer with the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division. He now is a project manager for the Commission on Federal Election Reform. Last night, the UN Security Council approved the creation of an international tribunal to try suspects in the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Meanwhile, fighting continues for the 11th day between the Lebanese army and Fatah al-Islam. On Wednesday, a brief truce was held at the Nahr el-Bared refugee camp in Tripoli, allowing aid convoys to deliver drinking water, food, and medicine. Mediators from the major Palestinian factions continue to negotiate with the Lebanese government in order to divert what many in the Palestinian community say could lead to an uprising if the indiscriminate shelling of the refugee camp continues. Jackson Ellers and Simba Russo report.
Located near the northern coastal city of Tripoli, Nahr el-Bared was home to over 31,000 Palestinians. According to the UN, more than 25,000 residents have fled to the nearby Badawi refugee camp, while others remain trapped inside. Khaled Yamani is an official with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and a youth organizer in the Badawi camp.
We don't want them to start a war with us, but at the end of the day, there are people getting killed, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are some people in Nahr el-Bared who are fighting alongside Fatah al-Islam because if people are dying, their families are dying, what are they supposed to do?
In an interview with Al-Ashaq Al-Assad newspaper, Parliament Majority Leader Saad Hariri said, quote, "The safety of the civilian residents of the refugee camp is our biggest concern. And this is why the army is in no rush to attack Fatah al-Islam terrorists. Once the evacuation of the civilians is completed, the army will deal with Fatah al-Islam," end quote. Like other aid officials, Yamani says the conditions are dire for those trapped in Nahr el-Bared, and if the actions of the Lebanese army continues to harm innocent civilians, it could incite further outrage.
The situation can get dangerously explosive, putting aside the issue of Fatah al-Islam and other similar groups. But the anger is brewing amongst the Palestinians because it is their people who are being killed and it is not being taken into consideration, and this anger may even manifest itself outside the bounds of official Palestinian structures.
On Wednesday, a Lebanese military court filed charges against 20 suspects for being members of Fatah al-Islam and attacking Lebanese troops. The Nahr el-Bared refugee camp has been the scene of the worst internal fighting since the Lebanese civil war. Dozens have been killed and hundreds wounded. Representatives of the main Palestinian factions in Lebanon continue to hold ongoing talks with the Sinura government on a four-point plan to peacefully deal with Fatah al-Islam and secure the safety of residents trapped inside to avoid further civilian casualties.
ما لا يقل عن 17 شهيدا في المخيم I know that there are no less than 17 martyrs in the camp, and that there are 180 injured and around 200 houses that have been damaged. As Palestinian factions, we feel hurt and sad because these are our people, and we hope that civilians who have been here for over 60 years are not subjected to this kind of shelling.
Haj Rifat is the director of media for the mainstream Fatah faction and the spokesperson for the multi-party Palestinian Liberation Organization in Lebanon.
That's why we raised our voices as representatives of the Palestinian people, as Fatah and the PLO, and we said that we condemn this type of shelling on the camps and that there needs to be precision on the part of the army if the targets are these groups.
Although the army continues strengthening its position around the camp, the Lebanese government has expressed fears that violence could erupt at the 11 other Palestinian refugee camps if the army breaks the 1969 Cairo Accord, which bans the Lebanese army from entering the camps. But the stance of the U.S.-backed government has been one of not negotiating with Fatah al-Islam, and observers say that the Lebanese leadership is leaning more towards an all-out assault on the Nahr el-Bared camp. From the Badawi camp in northern Lebanon, this is Jackson Allers and Simba Rousseau for Free Speech Radio News.
Governments and energy companies around the world are beginning to acknowledge the threats of climate change. But the solutions they are considering are varied and controversial, including proposals for carbon capture and storage technology. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
It sounds like a utopian dream. The world's biggest energy companies going green, burning coal, the dirtiest of all fossil fuels, and gas for our energy needs, but capturing the CO2 emissions and, they claim, storing them deep underground forever. Along with plans for a new generation of nuclear power stations, Tony Blair hailed it as central to Britain's new low-carbon energy mix.
Global warming is the greatest long-term threat to our planet's environment. Scarce energy resources mean rising prices and will threaten our country's economy. Do you know, in 15 years, we will go from 80% self-sufficient in oil and gas to 80% of it imported. We need, therefore, the most radical overhaul of energy policy since the war. We will treble investment in clean technology, including clean coal, and we will take the necessary measures to meet one of the most ambitious targets on the environment set anywhere in the world. A 60% reduction in emissions by the year 2050.
It's not hard to see why politicians find it attractive. And companies like BP like the idea of public investment that helps them pump CO2 into oil fields because it makes extraction easier and cheaper. They've joined forces with coal giant Rio Tinto. They like it because it means they ensure ever larger markets for their coal. And all in the name of the environment. Charlie Cronick of Greenpeace.
What big coal, big nuclear power does, it allows you to leave the system more or less the same as it is now. It perpetuates the idea that we don't have to change anything about our incredibly inefficient energy system to solve the problem of global warming. This idea that we can attach one bit of kit onto the end of a very, very big pipe and solve the problem. And in that regard, it's a very, very misplaced hope.
BP had promised to build the world's first major carbon capture power plant in Scotland. But recently it pulled out of the project, blaming government delay in awarding subsidies. Charlie Cronick again.
Greenpeace's view is that if the industry think carbon capture and storage is such a great idea, well, let them invest their own money in it. We've probably got between 10 to 15 years to peak our global emissions in carbon dioxide and then start to reduce. Pretty sharpish, actually. So the idea of investing money in a technology that's not going to be commercially viable for around 10 years, it just doesn't seem like a good investment.
Also, there's a limit to government spending of public money, and the UK government may have already leaped. Hence BP pulling the plug on carbon capture in the UK, for now. Editor of the Petroleum Review, Chris Grabowski.
Even a government only has so much money in it. It has got to work out where it spends that, because if they are really committed to nuclear, there will have to be all sorts of investment guarantees, simply because of the nature of that sort of industry. Now, if the government has, as it looks like, plumbed fairly clearly for nuclear, the effective subtext is that there then is less money available to support some of these other technologies and some of these other promises.
And that's including renewable energy as well, isn't that the case?
Certainly, the way it looks at the moment, that would be the conclusion you'd come to.
So, no one knows if Tony Blair's clean coal project will get public money and go ahead here or not. If it does, any further subsidy will only add to the $150 billion a year oil, coal and gas companies already receive globally. And, says Greenpeace, a carbon capture venture diverts attention away from the need to radically change the energy system itself, in favour of energy efficiency and legislation. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
From his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Police and Thieves. It has been years since I heard the reggae song Police and Thieves by Jamaican crooner Junior Marvin. With his delightful falsetto, he sang of police and thieves in the street. Oh yeah, frightening the nation with their guns and ammunition. The song swam through decades of time, and like any truly good reggae song, based on the trials and tribulations of the poor, spoke volumes of the brotherhood between police and thieves, partners in a slimy, grimy business. I thought of it when I heard of a motorcycle gang who assembled to protest our birthday celebrations in Philadelphia in April. A biker gang? Where does this come from? I've met a few bikers in prison. Some called themselves pagans, outlaws, or hell's angels. They were major drug users, occasionally drug dealers, and saw themselves as the last of a vanishing breed, people seeking to live free in a society fast becoming less free. They were committed nonconformists who believed in living on the margins of society as, well, outlaws. How does a group of outlaw bikers stand against people fighting for freedom? Perhaps more importantly, why would the cops invite a group best known for their criminality to stand with them? I think it says more about the Philadelphia police than it does about a ragtag bunch of bikers. Philadelphia has had cops in full uniform and name tag robbing drivers in broad daylight. Some years ago, Philadelphia was the site of the 39th District scandal, when cops were kidnapping and robbing people throughout North Philly, a practice that lasted for at least a decade. So the question isn't why would cops hook up with outlaws, it's why wouldn't they? Cops establish close working relationships with criminals, especially criminal snitches. They work with thieves, whores, muggers, and thugs. And when it comes to political cases, anything goes. We now know that the U.S. government worked with mafia hitmen to try to kill Fidel Castro in Cuba. So why hook up with a biker gang unless their intent was to try to terrorize people fighting for freedom? Perhaps they were biker snitches paying off debts to their police benefactors. I actually think it was the former rather than the latter. Police and bikers, cops and criminals, united in their one commonality of whiteness. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. To find out how you can support FSRN's programming, visit our website at www.fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Tana Gise and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young, and our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kung.